So hopefully you picked up a copy of the lesson. It's lesson 10. It's not often that you hear teaching on evolution in church, but we find it necessary from time to time. Just like next week, we will hear teaching on Islam. And the purpose is not to promote it, of course, but to understand it so that we might be able to converse more intelligently and even have conversations with those who are Muslims, and in this case, those who are evolutionists. So we need to understand where they're coming from intellectually, that we might be able to engage them. And in the conference to come next week, one of the things we're going to be doing in the second session on Saturday is showing a video of a gentleman's testimony, Nabil Qureshi. Some of you might have heard him. He worked with Ravi Zacharias, and he was a Muslim, very devout Muslim, grew up in such a home, and converted to Christianity. So you're going to hear his testimony, and as well as some information about Islam and Muslims. And it makes it a lot more personal when we understand it, and a little bit more open and able then to converse. And that's exactly what happened in his life. A young man, I won't spoil it, so I'll stop there. That's what I find interesting, is the personal testimonies of the results of people becoming knowledgeable in the area of apologetics and then actually leading people to Christ because of it, or using that as a tool. So the question is, what is Darwinian evolution? That's the topic of today. Goes by many forms, some forms of atheistic evolution represent Darwinian evolution. It's also called materialistic evolution, denoting that there is no being or God responsible for it. The only thing that drives this evolution is what we can see, feel, hear, touch, the material world. That's it. So it's a godless, unguided, materialist evolution. It's also referred to as the general theory of evolution. And that encompasses the whole shebang of Darwinian evolution, being atheistic and materialist. And the latest technical word that you will hear thrown around is neo-Darwinian evolution. So Darwin, of course, was back in the mid-1800s when he produced his literature, and a little bit later on this became accepted, but then there were fields of science that came into being after that that people used to support evolution. And adding that into the mix, that's why it's labeled neo-Darwinian evolution. The basic concepts remain the same, but just defined a little bit more and added to by new science coming in. So we have to look at definitions a little bit. All words are always important, and as we converse with people and we throw around this word evolution, sometimes we have to define what are we talking about. You might be saying evolution, I might be saying evolution and meaning two different things. And so we have to establish that. That's kind of important. And so the first two definitions there I took right out of Merriam-Webster. The number one definition is the process by which different kinds of living organisms are believed to have developed from earlier forms during the history of the Earth. And that's the one that's fairly akin to Darwinian evolution. That's what they're referring to there. However, evolution, in its basic term, can also mean, number two, just the gradual development of something. And so if somebody asks you, do you believe in evolution? Yeah, we see the gradual development of things throughout life. That does not mean we believe in number one, but we have to define our terms. All right, so there we are. What are some other meanings or thoughts regarding this word evolution? Well, there's microevolution, the concept that living organisms can adapt and make minor changes. And so some of the examples that are out there, I'll use Darwin's example of the finches that may have started with one type of finch, but because of the different types of feed available and habitat changes, you ended up with a number of different finches with different size bills, thickness of bills, and he called them different species then. And so you had one species change into different species. That's more or less microevolution. Does that happen? Possibly. And the problem is extrapolating that out into a bigger picture of change. And we'll talk about that. But there is this thing of microevolution. You see it in bacteria. And the bacteria is one of the prime examples that evolutionists will point to when they want to give you a proof for evolution. But when you really look at what's happening, I would say that's in the realm of microevolution. Small changes. Now, scripture, just to go back, it says God produced or created animals, these things, after their own kind. So when we talk about a species changing into a different species, you look at dogs, for example. A kind of a dog might have been a very generic dog, all right? And over the years, we have seen different types of dogs because of the variety of maybe genetic material in a dog could change and evolve, micro-evolve into different types of dogs, coyotes, foxes, what have you, and even some of the domestic animals. And so there is room in Scripture to kind of understand what might be happening in the area of microevolution. But a dog becoming a horse is a completely different matter. Okay, so that's macroevolution. So we have to make some distinctions between micro and macroevolution. And that macroevolution is a critical linchpin to Darwinian evolution. And then, of course, there is theistic evolution, and theistic evolution could be a variety of forms also. It could be theistic evolution in the sense that God is directing the steps of change from one kind of animal into another kind of animal. And he's intervening there. And then there is our theistic evolutionists who say that, no, God just created all the physical material and the environment, put it into motion, and stepped back and allowed the Darwinian principles of natural selection to be unguided, randomly by chance. Then over the years, evolution has taken place, one kind of animal turning into a more complex kind of animal. So there's variations there. And then, of course, I like the term unguided evolution because that kind of defines really what's happening in Darwinian evolution. What they're saying is that there is no guiding principle. There is no intelligent source, or as Doran would like to say, no intentional source. There is no God involved there. So that's a little bit just a discussion on definitions. Sometimes understanding that is needed when we get into this discussion of evolution, because different people mean different things by evolution, and kind of have to try to settle that at the outset. Hopefully that wasn't too confusing. So we'll go to history now of evolution, and you'll get a sense of where this all comes from, and then we'll talk about the major components of Darwinian evolution, and then I'll try to summarize some thoughts regarding that. This is all a setup, by the way. All a setup for the next lesson, which will be the last lesson, of how do we defend against Darwinian evolution. And so that's the next lesson. So some of the history. Well, it started out, ancient Greek philosophers talked about life coming from non-life and man descending from animals. And no Mark Garman. Is Mark Garman here?
Maybe.
I'm not old enough to have been back in these conversations, so I don't know exactly how they came about or where they were. He's always given me a hard time about being old. That's all I know. So I'm just throwing that out as a fact that this is, you know, not something new on the scene, that historically from ages past people have had these ideas of life coming from non-life and then man descending from animals. Okay, so it's not a new concept. However, when Charles Darwin comes onto the scene, he adds some explanation to all of this scientifically. For his big discovery was natural selection of more competent animals and organisms over others, and therefore a genetic shift. Yeah, he didn't even use the word genetics. He knew nothing about genetics. But a shift in populations from this form to another form. And that came from his observations. He wrote his famous book on the origin of species. It was published in 1859. And this was a result of his travels to study fossils in animals, such as the tortoises and the finches on the Galapagos Islands. And I'm sure you've heard some of that and his observations there. He returned with his idea of the fixation of species, which is that was the current science, that species were fixed, they didn't change. That idea was shaken, and he came up with the concept of natural selection to explain it. And the irony that I see in it as you read his history is that during these travels, he came across the horrors of slave trading on his journeys, and he was actually appalled by it. But if you're a person who buys into natural selection, well, it's the survival of the fittest that would be just what should happen, a natural consequence. However, I'm told that Darwin and his folks actually said what he discovered disproved the variations in or the differentiations in the races of men. And I'm not sure how they got that, but we know the result of his work was not that. The result was classifying people differently because of the evolutionary concept that some races would become superior to others. And that's been the result of it. But that just gives you a little insight of where Darwin was at that time. The concept of common descent then was accepted in the science world shortly after. Darwin did not really deal with a couple of things. One would be the origin of the universe or the origin of life. So when you add those concepts then it becomes more of the general theory of evolution. Darwin more or less specifically honed in on natural selection and that kind of idea. And yes, he birthed this whole idea of natural selection by natural processes, which people came along and basically added to it. God was not part of the scene. And so it was built upon as the years went by. So the common theory of evolution was developed later, as Darwin was not necessarily a strict materialist nor even an atheist himself. No doubt he was an agnostic at best, which just goes to show you, I think of that passage where the Lord actually in the book of Revelation, I think he's talking to I can't remember which the church was, but he said, I'd rather have you hot or cold, but that you are lukewarm, I will spit you out of my mouth. And I think at this really illustrates the danger of someone who, I think I believe in God, but I'm not sure. He was neither hot nor cold. And even though he wasn't an atheist and didn't represent at the time evolution, the general theory of evolution as we see it today, he certainly sponsored the whole thing. And this is what came as a result of his being lukewarm, really. So the modern concept of evolution finds its basis in the work of Darwin, but his work did not necessarily represent the atheistic evolution of today, which is that's the point I wanted to get across. So Darwin gets a hard knock deservedly so, but probably not because of the common reason that he's responsible for the common theory of evolution, but more so he deserves the hard knock because he was at best a lukewarm believer. And this is the result of that. So what are the... Okay, one more sentence there in that to finish out the history. The last sentence, neither Darwin nor his colleagues knew, should be anything, of genetics yet. Somebody's laughing, Linda. Cross it out, nothing, it's anything. I think Claudia does not all proofread my notes here. She should. I know. So anyhow, he did not know anything of genetics. And so when this field of study was incorporated into the theory of evolution, it became more known as neo-Darwinian evolution. And so that's the modern-day term because of these new fields being added to it, new bits of information. It's still basic Darwinian evolution, but it's been enhanced, so to speak. And so that's the history of it. Major components. So what is it exactly? Okay. First statement is there is a common descent and ancestry among all life. So it's not common design. That's not why chimpanzees have arms and legs and we have arms and legs. It's because of a common design of a creator. It's because, well, one of those animals descended from another one of those animals and retained those traits. So it's common descent, common ancestry, and they take that all the way back to single cell organisms, the beginning of life. Microevolution is observed, and the inference to macroevolution is accepted. All right, and macroevolution being one species changing into a different species or changing into some other higher classification of an animal, dog becoming a horse, for example. And so that's what has been, that's the trend here. And hopefully you get this trend of these observations being made and then an extrapolation being made to a bigger concept, which is completely accepted and becomes part of the theory. You see this all the way through Darwinian evolution. The second point, at the end of the page there, natural selection is the means for this evolution. And so this is what Darwin observed on the islands. Again, talking about the finches. He didn't talk with the finches that I know of. Talking about the finches, and he saw this great variety. And some had large bills, some had thin bills. Thin bills able to get inside plants and retrieve things. The thick bills able to crush larger seeds. And so this variety of finches accommodated to their environment. And they were being naturally selected because there were some finches in his mind that would not have the bills capable for doing these things, and they would not have survived, but those who had the thick bills and could crush big seeds, they would survive, and so they were being selected. That was his observation. So a population of organism has variations in certain features, and some variations are favorable. More offspring are produced than can survive, and those that survive have these favorable traits. And then you see the population shift. So the population will change over time, and this is all unguided and random. Okay. You can flip your page. The geologic and fossil record, as well as modern population genetics, which is what I just referred to, are claimed to confirm the major components of Darwinian evolution. There was a lot that Darwin didn't know at the time. I think that's all interesting. Darwin made a lot of statements. I could have made a whole page full of statements of his own, like, personal doubts. I think there's a book written, I know there is, Darwin's Doubt. Very good book, one of the best books to read from what I understand in this area to understand what Darwin was thinking. And he had a lot of doubt about his theory. And it was justified. But later on, people took what Darwin started and added to it with their worldview, and it became something pretty much different. So there was a lot that Darwin didn't know at the time. For example, now it is known that mutations occur. So Darwin didn't know anything about the genetics level or mutations. And mutations are what is believed to be one of the chief mechanisms explaining the variation in species. And so this is another example. I'll talk about this a little bit later. Mutations, they do occur. You can observe them. So it's one of those things that is observable on a certain level, and it's extrapolated to become much a bigger tenet or belief and pillar of Darwinian evolution. And again, this constantly occurs. Second point there, in general, a vast amount of time is necessary to see the great variety of life we see today. Because the process of mutation and then environmental distress and selection is really not efficient and happens in small increments in a very random and undirected manner. And this is one of Darwin's doubts. Yes, Pastor.
Are you going to talk about punctuated equilibrium?
I was going to touch on that. So this was a problem for, and if I forget, bring it up. but I hope to hit that. So this was a problem for Darwin because the current understanding that it was a young Earth and there just was not enough time. And then as geologists came onto the field, some contemporary to Darwin, some a little bit later, they started talking about hundreds of thousands of years of the Earth being old. And Darwin still didn't see that this was enough time. And he never did this was always this. He died thinking that there's just not enough time for this to happen. Of course, later on, one of the scientific developments was the discovery of, you know, how old the universe is and how old the Earth is. And to those who have glommed on to the idea of evolution, well, this was good news to them. What's that? This was good news to them. Now they have millions of years. And that sounds like a long time to us, and so it's just accepted, well, that was enough time for all of this to happen. I completely disagree, and that will be one thing we touch on in the next lesson, is that that's still not enough time for this to happen. And we'll talk a little bit more, as I say, about this mutation process. So, with the origin of the universe around 17 billion years ago, and the origin of life happening around 3.5 billion years ago, it is claimed that this provides a significant amount of time for evolution to produce the complexity of life we see today. That's just a statement that they throw out there, and it sounds like to everybody, the common person especially, well, yeah, that's enough time to do anything. And in reality, it is not enough time. Yes? We are always evolving, according to them. Yeah, and yeah, all of the technology that we're developing, that's part of our evolutionary process, and
I thought we were going to grow extra toes.
No, only if we need them. That was bigger heads. Yeah. Well, yeah, you're into the sci-fi world. Yes. So he was a scientist, and he was educated as such, as far as I know. But his actual studies, and I think maybe he spent 20 years doing this, taking these voyages and trips. And I think he was associated with money, well-connected to people. And when he started publishing this data, there were other people also who had some similar theories, and he just put it in writing and put it in the context where people go like, yeah, that's what I've been thinking all along. And so with his, and it really was his journeys on that ship called the Beagle or whatever that really, it made for interesting reading, I believe. He's going to this exotic place, describing exotic. So it played well. I think that was that's what brought him onto the stage. Okay. The time thing is just not enough, but that's a claim that they make. Lastly here, there is no real solid theory on the origin of the universe in the common theory. We talked a little bit about that the last lesson of their alternative of string theory and the multiverse. That's kind of the best they could come up with, but you also hear stories of, life had to be seeded onto this earth because, again, they recognize, a lot of them, that there's just not enough time to evolve the complexity of life that we see here. Knowing that the mechanism that they have of natural selection mutation just doesn't cut it, just not possible. And so you hear this idea of life from aliens having to have been seeding this life onto Earth to give it the start that it needed. So there's no really good theory out there when it comes to the origin of the universe. And there really is, there's some accepted possible pathways for the origin of life arising from non-living material. But this has changed rapidly over even just the last years. You hear about the primordial soup. That's what I was taught growing up. And that's how life begins. Primordial soup, lightning strikes it, and somebody tried to replicate all of that with some false hopes and didn't really pan out. So they've completely almost discarded that. Now it's, where did life evolve? Down deep in the ocean rifts where there's hot vents, gases, and then life started down there. There's no oxygen down there. But that's their best theory. So none of these are very good, really. But that's the state of Darwinian evolution in a really small nutshell right now. So I'm going to make some summary statements, and then maybe if we have time for some more comments. Neo-Darwinian evolution is the accepted theory of explaining the origin of man and the existence of complex biology that we see today in most major secular institutions. This is the state of where we live. This is it. So in public schools, secular academia, universities, national institutes and academies of science and world science bodies, this is their accepted definition of origins and evolution of man. That's where we find ourselves. It's interesting, the last time I taught with kids, I had them bring in their science textbooks, their biology textbooks on Wednesday evenings, and we went through the section on evolution. And one of the things that was just fascinating to see is they did this very same thing. They spent a lot of time on these small observations on a micro level, and then they make these grandiose statements that because we see this, it means this. And it just kind of leaves it at that. And to point out to your kids, this is what's happening, I think is very valuable, of this extreme inference to major concepts that are accepted, that become major tenets of the common theory of evolution, based on just small observations. I define that a little bit later here. But that's where we are, so we accept that. That's the bad news, of course. I try to add some good news here in the next paragraph. Many of these organizations, especially their members, are not completely antagonistic toward a belief in God and will point out some of their respected scientists as believers. This is my experience as I read through these places. I read reviews of the National Academy of Science or something like that, and every now and then they'll have a review on what's the latest creationist thing. And they will. They'll point out that, well, even in our society, we have evangelical believers and name such and such. I think that's interesting. They usually propose, these organizations usually propose that creation account be taken allegorically and tend to radically separate the world of science and faith. So while they might not be completely closed-minded to a God being part of this evolutionary process, it's certainly theistic evolution. The creation account is allegorical. It's at best and a myth, most likely. And they really separate the world of science and theology. And that's somehow the way they cope with the issues that they have. However, they seem to be recognizing that the why behind all of the science cannot be answered by science. Now, sometimes we hear, like the four horsemen of the atheist, you know, those people talking, and they're very virulent and outspoken and in your face about evolution and there's no God. I don't think that's a fair representation of the typical evolutionist myself, as I read and I hear these people. They are open to a certain extent, because I think they can understand that the metaphysical questions, their science cannot answer that. So the materialist aspect, they have a problem with. Most people do. And I think that's important to keep in mind. Additionally, I know a number of, not personally, but I know a number of evolutionary biologists are questioning whether the current mechanisms of macroevolution are sufficient to explain some of their own data, such as the Cambrian explosion. So just real briefly, the Cambrian explosion is in their, it's part of their scheme of the fossil record, and we see about 350 years ago a lot of simple life forms, and within a relatively short period of time, you see an explosion in the fossil record of many, many complex life forms appearing, vertebrates. I think that's what I said, yeah.
You actually said 350 years.
Oh, sorry. I didn't sleep well last night, so that's my excuse. 350 million years ago, the Cambrian explosion, a whole lot of new life forms appeared, and almost you could say relativistic in time scale, suddenly. Well, that cannot be explained by this slow, random mutation and selection process. That's very, very inefficient. And so this is where some of them came up with this idea of punctuated equilibrium. And so that they built into the system that there could be times when in the evolutionary time scale, there would be naturally times when you would see spurts and big jumps in changes in the evolutionary. I'm not so sure what the mechanism is behind that to justify that. Maybe you can explain it. But Steve Gould, I guess, was the one who proposed this.
Steve Gould formulated the theory, but the problem that he was wrestling with was that evolution is a spontaneous generation model. It believes in spontaneous generation. And so he said the problem is that there really aren't transitional forms in the fossil record to justify the belief in evolution. And so what we rather see are these very punctuated jumps of rapid change in form without transition. And that was specifically why I began to formulate the model. It got applied to the Cambrian explosion. But the issue was there just isn't enough time in his belief to produce as much evolutionary change as we have, and there aren't transitional forms.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to just have rapid spontaneous generation rather than time-based spontaneous generation.
And it's just kind of like, well, it just had happened that way. I don't know the mechanism behind that.
There's no mechanism.
Right.
It just happens.
Okay.
We actually have to come up with a mechanism.
All right.
Age, and therefore with these catastrophic events that cause more when the client is to a catastrophic tipping point, that's actually a good thing because...
So we're going to encourage the evolution of man, right?
Evolution to occur in a rapid sequence.
Yes, yes. Dave? That believe in Christian colleges that believe in neo-Darwinian evolution, I would.
So when we send our kids to what's labeled Christian,
yeah.
How, at what problems would they run into this as the major end of the faculty in the science department?
Well, that depends on your definition of Christian college, of course. So if you're talking about a Christian evangelical college that we would send our kids to, I would say probably zero, because it's a godless form. It's directly against creation account completely. So I would say there would be no neo-Darwinian evolutionist in that type of Christian college. However, you would probably have at least one, or if there's a faculty of 10 bio professors, probably one or two of them are theistic evolutionists. I could say that. Does that make sense? So I think that's the best way I can answer. A conservative Christian college that we would send to, I would not expect to hear this being taught. However, theistic evolution, you would expect to hear at some point from some of the professors.
Nate, the number I was given by BioLogos was 70%.
In Christian colleges. Okay. I can't speak for that, so maybe they're correct.
The number they gave me was 70%.
For, quote, Christian colleges. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and there are a lot of those out there. And they're secular colleges.
Like Taylor University, yep. Grove City, places like that.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, I got to move on. One.
All the great universities were all founded as Christian colleges.
Sure, and we know what has happened to them. Well, let me finish this, and then if we have time, a few more comments. So as I walk through this and I read, I see these doubts, and I see some of this, and I believe the last sentence there, these are crucial touch points for a believer to begin discussions with the neighbor, not your next door neighbor, but biblically your neighbor that you come across from time to time who is an evolutionist. In other words, there is an open door. They are not completely closed on a personal level. I do not think they're completely closed-minded to this. And I discovered this with my researcher friend that I talked about a while ago, who I thought was probably a Darwinian evolutionist. And as I got into the discussion with him, no, he said there's a guided process. So that was an open door to have more conversation in this area of evolution. Now, while there are a number of supporting arguments for the general theory of evolution, many of these observations are simply extrapolated into the accepted certainties which have not been proven. Okay? I'll give you a few examples. Beneficial mutations. Of course, this whole scheme of natural selection based on variety and genetic mutation now being the source or reason for this variety, is where they say is that's how it takes place. But there's a lot of question. Are there any beneficial mutations? Almost all of them are negative when we observe even today. Some of them are just innocuous. So most of them are negative. A grand large part of them are just innocuous. They don't mean anything, don't have any changes. Very, very few examples, as I read in the literature, can be pointed to say beneficial. And even if that's the case, it's hard to determine that they're beneficial. I'll give you some examples quickly. One would be the sickle cell anemia, which is obviously lethal. If it's homozygous, you have two forms of the allele. Your red blood cells are disformed, and they're not going to work correctly. And it's not going to be good news. But if you only have one of those alleles, one of those mutations, then Some of them are deformed well enough so that if you live in a tropical climate where malaria is, your red cells don't get infected with malaria. So they see that as a beneficial mutation. But that's a very specific case in a very specific spot in the population. And it's not beneficial to the rest of the organisms of that population at other parts of the earth. So that's a common one that's presented as that's a beneficial mutation. There's another one out there, a mutation of a gene that is somewhat protective against HIV antigen, CCR X5 or something like that. Claudia might know, or Heather might know. But so these people are fairly protected from HIV infection. However, on the flip side, and there's usually a flip side to all of these beneficial mutations, flip side is they're more susceptible to hepatitis and other infections. So while these instances are a given as beneficial mutations, there's a legitimate question as to really are they. But there are, they can point to something like that, and they will extrapolate it out to a bigger tenet and say, well, these beneficial mutations have actually brought about new species because of survival of the fittest and so forth. So really huge extrapolations. Bacteria is used today as a common example, and bacteria, again, is just, it's a whole total different beast. Nothing you give drugs to a certain bacteria, it changes the DNA actually to become resistant to that drug. And they say that's a beneficial mutation. Not even close to being applicable to organisms. In fact, even in those cases, those bacteria that do become resistant to the drug then have a deleterious effects as well if they follow and continue to measure the effect of that mutation. So not really the case at all, but they extrapolate that into a huge, huge big deal. Well, that's the idea, and I don't know the science of it that well. I actually just looked at malaria parasites last week, but not to that question as to does that protect that population better. I think the best you could say that some people are, yes, protected better in that particular climate because of that mutation. But the question is, overall, to the organism, is that beneficial? And I think the question is unanswered at best, and it's probably the answer is no. Because to the organism as itself, and that's how you have to look at this, as an entire population, not just a small segment of population. It might be beneficial for them, but if it's not, it's deleterious for the whole.
I think a good answer to that question is that mutations lose information, where adaptability in the beaks was benefiting from information that was there.
Already present, correct.
So it's kind of ironic in that the beaks example argues rather strongly that somebody somewhere designed in the information to begin with.
Absolutely.
So that those animals could adapt as things change. In other words, God built resilience,
yes,
into his creation because he knew things were going to happen, things were going to change, and all the impact of environment and stuff.
That's
mutations are losing information, and that's why they're deleterious.
Yeah, that's exactly. It's common design my lack of sleep is whatever you said. I agree. Transition species, missing links, that's the common word. You can throw up that first slide if you would. There you go. There's an example, the back one. Okay. That's what I'm looking for. It's not there. Yeah, you have to turn around and look at that beast. That's a transition species, okay? They take some examples like this. This is supposed to be the walking whale, all right? So it's a whale that swam in salt water or fresh water, but it was also had the ability to walk. And so they take from this creature and say, that's how whales evolved. They were once walking animals, and then they became swimming animals and eventually turned into a whale. I mean, you can just see, first of all, is that a transition species, or is it just a species that was alive at one point and died out and had nothing to do with transition? So you can see, I don't really make a big deal of missing links, because they can bring up animals like this, and what are you going to say? There's not much you can say. Whatever you say is pretty much conjecture. And so, but they take this and build this into a big part of their theory, that yes, there were missing links.
One thing you could say or ask is, where are the hundreds of thousands of transitions between this organism and that big whale?
Yes. Well, exactly. Another example would be the extended age of the Earth. We talked a little bit about that. There's just not enough time, even if there was millions of years. They take these small things and expand them. So just to finish out quickly here, even more importantly, from an apologetic approach, aside from these little scientific evidences that they have, there are just major tenets of the common theory of evolution that are sheer conjecture. And you can put that definition up. I don't know if it comes up here. Doesn't. My apologies. Sheer conjecture, and are therefore easy points of attack even for the non-scientist, as we will see next lesson. So we tend to be, do not be intimidated by the evolutionists, is what I'm saying. And hopefully the next lesson you'll see that this whole concept of evolution is a very easy one to attack. It's the major lie that attacks creation account, but it is a very easy target to attack. And we don't have to get into a lot of science. We just talked about a little of the science. It's easy to do that here, and you can, but you don't even have to go there. And we'll find out next week more about that. So I apologize. I don't know if we're out of time. This is just one of those classes where it would be great to have some more time, but to cover the material, my apologies, we don't. So we will finish not next week, but the week to follow, and give you what I think is a great apologetic against evolution. So let's pray. Father, again, we thank you for our time together. We do lift up the worship service here to follow, that you might be glorified, that we might turn our focus and attention to you, our great, great hope. And we thank you for all that you've done for us, and even in this time. And we ask this in Jesus' name. Amen.